In celebration of Black History Month, we highlight a profile in excellence, Harriet Tubman, who will potentially soon replace Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill. Born into enslavement in Maryland, Harriet Tubman escaped to freedom in Pennsylvania in 1849 to become the most famous conductor on the Underground Railroad, an elaborate secret network of safe houses. For more on the life of Harriet Tubman, we speak with Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, Dr. Gregory Carr. Dr. Carr, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Always glad to be here. Always glad to be with you, sis.
Thank you. So I wanted to start with the environment that Harriet was born into and grew up in. Can you talk about the slave environment that she was born in and a little bit about her upbringing?
Yeah, she, when we don't know for sure exactly what year she was born. We know it was in the early 1820s, maybe as early as 1820 or as late as 1822. Araminta Ross, which was her birth name, Minty was her nickname. And I think that's important because she has entered our consciousness as Harriet Tubman, and that was a name that most historians agree. And of course, she left an account, as told to account, as she gave herself right around the time she married her husband, John Tubman. But she was born in Dorchester County, Maryland. That's on the eastern shore of Maryland. And a lot of folks think of the Mason-Dixon line separating the North and the South. We know that. That phrase, Mason-Dixon line, but we probably don't stop enough to remember that the Mason-Dixon line separates Pennsylvania from Delaware. So anything south of Pennsylvania is considered the South. And those were, quote unquote, slave states, Delaware, where Richard Allen and Sarah Allen are from, the founders of the AME Church, among others. And then the eastern shore of Maryland is roughly parallel to Delaware and then extends south. Harriet Tubman was born, of course, separated from the mainland of Maryland, so to speak, by the Chesapeake Bay. Harriet Tubman was born on the eastern shore of Maryland on a plantation. And the county right next to her is actually Talbot County. That's where Frederick Douglass was born. And she was raised on that plantation by her parents, Harriet. See the renaming there, Green and Benjamin Ross. And she had eight brothers and sisters, and they had all she hit the ground running, as enslaved children often did, these prisoners of war on those death camps we call plantations. She began to work as a little girl right around the time now today little girls and boys would be going to kindergarten. She was working as a domestic servant. And she did that for her childhood up and through her adolescence. And she around the age she would have been going to middle school, 12 or 13, she was struck by a weight, an iron, 2-pound iron, in trying to get between an enslaver and someone who was being beaten, a brother who was being beaten. And it was that blow, that blow from that 2-pound iron, that gave her, left her with a physical challenge. After that, she had narcolepsy, intermittently severe headaches. If she were alive today, they may have diagnosed her as being differently abled or having had that malady. But of course, it didn't stop her from going on with her life. She married John Tubman in 1844, renamed herself, took her mother's name, and shortly thereafter began to first escape. She escaped from enslavement herself off the eastern shore of Maryland and then began to return. So the conditions finally for enslavement of African people on the eastern shore of Maryland, where you have tobacco, where you have the kind of crops that we would normally associate with enslavement, could be harsh to, relatively speaking, milder depending on your job, but it was enslavement nonetheless. We should never forget there's no such thing as a better enslavement. She was a prisoner of war like her fellow Africans.
Can you speak to what drove her? Because similar to Nat Turner, who's a Christian minister who led an armed uprising against slave owners, Harriet Tubman was a Christian but rejected the teachings of the New Testament that urged slaves to be obedient or turn the other cheek and embrace the Old Testament regarding tales of deliverance. In your opinion, in your estimation, what drove her to not only escape herself but to return over and over?
Well, I think much like Nat Turner, much like many of the Africans whose names we know, Sojourner Truth, for example, Fred Douglass, for example, and the millions whose names we would never know. And historians like Michael Gomez at New York University, Gwendolyn Midlow Hall down in Louisiana, and so many others over the years have speculated that the vast majority of African people in this country did not adopt Christianity until shortly before the U.S. Civil War. And I'm talking now about the enslaved. But like those millions, Harriet Tubman was deeply spiritual. And her spirituality was grounded in an African worldview, if we can be so expansive as to call it an African worldview. There's no one African worldview, but I think her faith, her belief, her conviction that the unseen, that the spiritual forces that shape our lives had more power than any physical force that she might encounter, including the human beings who would keep her and her fellow Africans enslaved. I think it was that's what drove her. She grew up on that Eastern shore being tutored by her father and his friends how to read the stars. She knew how to map the stars. This wasn't a magical ability, so to speak. You know, often in contemporary society, we look at figures like Harriet Tubman and Nat Turner as almost like magical Negroes. It's like a Hollywood reading of them. They came out of their mother's wombs and they had these gifts. Yeah, of course, they came out of their mother's wombs and they had these gifts, like all little children have gifts, but those gifts were developed by study. And Tubman learned how to read the stars, but there was a connection. And that's what helped her. She and her two brothers initially escape around 1849. And then as she came back and forth, taking people across that Mason-Dixon line into freedom, relative freedom, she had the faith of her convictions and the belief in a supreme being, the belief that she was guided by spirits and ancestors and she was shown signs. And she channeled those beliefs into the Christian Bible for sure. She became a stalwart member of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, which plays a prominent role to this day in maintaining her home in Auburn, New York, along with the National Park Services and other partners. But that Christianity is brought into an African sensibility. It's what Cedric Robinson might call an Afro-Christianity. It's communitarian. It's not individualist. She's not negotiating for her own soul salvation. She's working out the salvation of a people in the sense that we all go. We all got to go. It is about collective work, and it's about an ethic that says enslavement is a sin. It's not just a sin and a shame. It is a sin. It must be opposed. And those who maintain enslavement are working on behalf of the forces of evil. So I think that's what animated her. I mean, it's a worldview that says this world is not my home. I'm just passing through. And as I'm passing through, I will combat the evil as I engage it. It is indeed my obligation.
Wanted to talk about one of the things that could have slowed her down, but did not. The fugitive slave law, the law that changed in 1850. If you could talk about that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm not ambivalent at all about American history. I reject it as a framework for interpreting not only our experience as African people, but anyone's experience. I think the narratives of American exceptionalism just simply, not only can they not be sustained, they're not very useful. We start thinking about the kind of society we want to live in. That having been said, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, I find deeply inspiring. Not inspiring, obviously, by the fact that it was passed as a part of continuing negotiation in this kind of settler colonial criminal enterprise called the United States of America, as the country moved west, dispossessing our First Nation kin of their land and reaching compromise on which states would come in as quote unquote free and which would come in as slave. Because the Fugitive Slave Act is connected to the admission of California, of course, where you are to the Union. We know California came in 1850. All those school children learned that, but they don't know the circumstances. Part of it was a redoubling of a commitment by the federal government to return to the condition of enslavement any African who found their way into a quote unquote free state or free territory. That would allow California to come in as a quote-unquote free state, even as they're dispossessing Mexico of more of its land in the wake of the Mexican War of 1846. So that half decade where you see Araminta come to age and begin to her process of escaping and coming back, like 1845 to 1850, is a period of deep roiling in American history. The enterprise is expanding, settler colonialism is expanding, they're bringing in states. If you can get to a territory and get your numbers up, if you got more white people, white males who are saying they are against enslavement and for it, you can come in. They're saying maybe you can come in as a free state, you can come in as a slave state. Well, what happens, and of course we know in the decade after 1850, you get the Kansas-Nebraska Act, you get so-called Bleeding Kansas. This is, now we're going to connect to John Brown. But by the time you get to 1850, California coming in, the Fugitive Slave Act is saying we're going to return any Negro we find above in one of these quote-unquote free states to enslavement. The inspiring thing about it is the resistance. The resistance of Africans who continue to escape on that network called the Underground Railroad, which is not only the East Coast, but also the kind of what we would now call the Midwest, probably closer to the western edge of most of the states by that time, places like Cincinnati. You know, we think about Margaret Garner, who was the inspiration for Toni Morrison's book Beloved. When you cross from Kentucky, if you can get across that Ohio River into Ohio, that's a quote unquote free state. And so you see massive networks, and these networks are often grounded, not just with the assistance of white abolitionists, but they're grounded in black communities, and they're grounded by the black church. The AME church, these little towns with AME church churches are often doubling as places where they're hiding Africans who are escaping, coming along the Underground Railroad. Well, when the Fugitive Slave Act finally is passed, you see these black abolitionists with the most inspiring speeches. Oh my goodness, this is where in February, Carter G. Woodson, we talk about Black History Month. Woodson published a book called The Mind of the Negro as Revealed in Letters Written During the Crisis. And when you see this correspondence and then you read these speeches, he had a book called Negro Orators and Their Orations. A cat like Martin Delaney, who escaped, he and his, you know, his mother and him got them out of enslavement in what is now West Virginia into Pennsylvania. Delaney, when the Fugitive Slave Act is passed, he said, if somebody crosses the threshold of my house looking for a slave, may I lay him dead in my grave, or if I don't do it, then may the ground refuse me a grave. If a man crosses the threshold of my house and tries to take any of us as slaves, with the Constitution pinned to his chest, a letter from the President of the United States, I would say, let me then, in fact, lay him lifeless, a corpse before my feet. He gives this speech after they passed the Fugitive Slave Act, because what they start doing is raiding the North, looking for free Africans claiming they had escaped and trying to drag them into enslavement. It's the context for Solomon Northrup's Odyssey, which, of course, we know as 12 Years a Slave. Now, a lot of young people have seen that movie. It's the Fugitive Slave Act that triggers that. They go hunting for black people, but black people respond. And it kind of accelerates the crisis and ends up, of course, a decade later with the Civil War.
But she extended the, well, I'm not sure if she did it on her own, but in terms of, there was an extension of the Underground Railroad to Canada.
Yes. Yes. In fact, in that same period, you have people like Josiah Henson. Josiah Henson leaves the United States altogether. And that's another major city we think about. We should never forget Detroit, which, of course, folks in Detroit know you can look over and see Canada. Right. So people are going into Ontario. Josiah Henson, in fact, becomes the model for so-called Uncle Tom and Uncle Tom's Cabin. In fact, Martin Delaney gets on Frederick Douglass and says, hey, Harriet Beecher Stowe's written this novel. It's very nice. But is she giving any money to Josiah Henson, since she basically stole his identity? And she said, he told Douglass, get on your friend who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin and make sure she's taking care of Josiah Henson. I'm bringing that up because Josiah Henson, Mary Ann Shad Carey, Abraham Shad, the Shad family, these are black abolitionists who, along with white abolitionists, have established free colonies in Canada. And so Canada becomes a so-called promised land in many ways. Fast forward very quickly for 30 seconds to Martin Luther King. Dr. King gives a series of lectures for the Canadian Broadcasting Company near the end of his life, where he says black people have a special relationship to Canada because for many people during enslavement, Canada was the North Star. And so, yeah, those establishments were settled. But of course, Harriet Tubman takes advantage of that, because if you come all the way back across the continent to where she ends up in Auburn, New York, that's a short distance from Niagara, New York. And of course, right across there is the passage to Canada. So you see some people continuing to press on, continue to go, because they don't even trust the United States, the northern states, the so-called free states. So between Auburn, New York, Rochester, New York, Niagara, Troy, New York, you see the Negro Convention movements up there, Henry Highland Garnett and many others are saying we must press for resistance. And you see from the Canadian side, you see support coming. So no, she didn't create those destinations in the network, but she certainly enhanced them with her efforts of escape.
I wanted to talk about her involvement in the Civil War, connected to her being a scout and a spy. Now, I'm pretty clear on what a spy is, but I'm not so clear on what a scout is. working for the Union Army. But if you could talk about her involvement in the Civil War as a scout and as a spy.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. We think of the Civil War, 1861 to 1865, as something that came to an end in 1865 as the South surrendered. But they were major inroads into the South, Virginia, South Carolina, as early as 1861, 1862. By the time the Emancipation Proclamation is signed in 1863, Harriet Tubman finds herself in South Carolina. She's a volunteer for the Union Army. Now, mind you, you know, her husband was in the Union Army. In fact, that's how she ends up with a pension eventually. And that, we thank the school children in New York for that. If we have time, we can tell that little story. But Tubman is not a member of the Union Army because no woman is a member of the Union Army. And so, but she knows how to navigate plantations, navigate again using the stars as a central source, the woods, the fields, the terrain. And so she worked in the Union Army in many ways in support roles. You know, she's serving as a nurse, she's doing support stuff. But then they ask her, could you basically serve as a subversive? In other words, go into these places, gather intelligence, connect with black people because they don't trust us. And can you avoid getting caught? And she's, duh, what you think I've been doing? So anyway, so Harriet Tubman is often, you know, the first face that a lot of black people in South Carolina see who are on these plantations. And so, yeah, white boys, we don't trust y'all. We see you got a blue uniform on, but let's be clear. We see that white skin and we don't know what to do. Tubman becomes almost an ambassador for freedom as she's entering these plantations. Then, after the Emancipation Proclamation is signed, nearing the summer of 1863, Colonel James Montgomery, who was an abolitionist, but he was in charge of the 2nd South Carolina Volunteers. This is a black regiment. The 1st South Carolina Volunteers, they called them the Gospel Army. These are these Africans who have been enslaved who come into the Union Army and said, we're going to free ourselves. So what does she do with Colonel Montgomery and these brothers in the 2nd South Carolina? They plan a raid. They're going to, and he had about 300 troops under his command. And Tubman, along with 8 other quote unquote scouts, again, see, they don't have a language to put the, you know, they really, what is a scout? Okay, you got to go out here and tell us what's going on. Okay, there's a lot of different language you can use, but you don't know what to do with me. And I'm a woman. There ain't no woman in the military. So you know what? Just let me do my thing. Can you do that? Okay. They get this raid together and they go June 1st, 1863, Tubman, Montgomery on a federal ship with a couple other gunboats. They come out of the St. Helena Sound toward the Combahee River and they end up going. Oh, by the way, she's directing this because she's already been out there and surveyed the terrain and she doesn't write things. They say she's illiterate. No, she's quite literate. She just doesn't write things down. She has committed all the stuff she's seen to memory. So her memory is superior to people who would say, oh, I'm literate. Are you? Do you remember this? No. Well, then be quiet. She shows them where to go. 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the next day, they go and start the gunboats start docking at strategic places. And there are all these Africans waiting on the boats to come. They're escaping to shore. They're escaping to the boats. They're getting off. More than 700 made it onto the gunboats. And as they're going onto the gunboats, they start setting fire to the plantations at the same time. So she's not only getting people to escape, they're destroying property, millions of dollars of property. Finally, the contemporary press at the time credit her with this work, but they don't even credit her by name. They call her the She Moses in one of the reports from the Wisconsin State Journal. But much later, you know, she gets credit. And this is one of the things you're doing today, Janine. We're having this conversation. But of course, she never gets paid for any of this because she's not a member of the Army. The only money she ever got from the military was through her husband's pension, and they had to fight for that.
So what are your thoughts then on Harriet Tubman being honored, they say, on the $20 bill?
Well, I suppose my thoughts are probably like yours, Janine. I won't speak for you, but I think about this. I had a student, Shanice Thompson, who is now on the faculty of Bowie State University. She wrote a paper on this. And, you know, Shanice talks about the cultural importance of having a Harriet Tubman, having the face there, representing the money. And, you know, she's from a different generation. And so I have to always keep that in mind when I say what I would say finally about it. You know, I don't like the idea of having her on the money. First of all, we don't even use money anymore in terms of cash money like that. I mean, but to the degree, you know, the idea that we might, you know, have her on the money is to me like almost like a guilt trip kind of excuse. Oh, what we did? Oh, yeah. Okay. But now, but do people have a living wage? Are people able to have health care? I mean, come on. What that money her face is on, is it getting into the pockets of the people who she would say need it? But the other side of it, quite frankly, I love the irony that you would take that slave driver, Andrew Jackson, off and put Harriet Tubman's. I think he would be apoplectic wherever he is. I doubt it's anywhere where he'd be close enough to have a conversation with Harriet Tubman. But yeah, that makes me kind of smile. And also, finally, the idea that when we travel in Africa, the Caribbean, where Black people's faces are on the money and have been for a very long time, that we might have a piece of paper. Like when I was in Ghana and, you know, showed these young people in Ghana a $1 bill with George Washington's face on it and tore it up and they almost lost their minds. That was about 25 years ago. And they said, oh, no, that's valuable. I said, no, it doesn't have my face on it. And this little boy came up and put a little 5-cent, 5-CD coin in my hand with a cowrie shell on it. He said, you take this back to your mother. Because what I told him was, my mama can't frame this dollar bill and put it on her wall with any pride, didn't have her face on it. And the little boy gave me that CD note, and I put it in my mother's hand. I said, this came from Ghana. This boy wanted you to have something with an African symbol on it. It is kind of nice, the thought that when we travel, we could put a symbol of a Black woman and say, look, we don't control the country, but at least like you, we at least got a piece of our money with the face of an African on it. So, I mean, those are the two sides of my opinion.
And before we before I let you go, I just wanted to be able to squeeze in a shout out to Cicely Tyson before we go. And anything you can say about her portrayal of Harriet Tubman in the 1978 movie, A Woman Called Moses.
Oh, sure. I can do that in 30 seconds. You know, the first woman to play Harriet Tubman in a kind of a broad sense was Ruby Dee around 1955. She was in a television staging of The Life of Harriet Tubman. But when we see Cicely Tyson play Harriet Tubman in A Woman Called Moses, that's only a couple of years after Sounder, where we really see that relationship between Black women and men. Cicely Tyson, people have talked about her grace, her beauty, her talent, her ability. It's the ethos. Harriet Tubman channeled through Cicely Tyson then connects Harriet Tubman to everyone from, you know, Sounder to Kunta Kinte's mother in Roots, forward to the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, all through the ethos of a woman from whose people are from the Caribbean, who always said, I will never portray any role that will be beneath the dignity of my people. So in many ways, you know, Cicely Tyson was a daughter of Harriet Tubman. And in that respect, the Underground Railroad she traveled was a path that allowed us to escape from the indignity of portrayals in mass white facing media to a kind of liberated zone where this generation can breathe free and not have to be in a space where they can't define themselves in their craft by anything less than their full humanity. So respect to the new ancestor. I hope they're somewhere chilling, she and Harriet Tubman having a conversation about that portrayal, even as we speak.
Well, Dr. Greg Carr, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
My friend Janine, I'm so glad always to do it. Look forward to talking to you next time. Happy Black History Month.
Thank you. Happy Black History Month. That was Dr. Gregory Carr. Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, speaking about the life of the most famous conductor on the Underground Railroad, Harriet Tubman, celebrating Profiles in Excellence for Black History Month.